Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
In 1860, Charles Darwin sent a book to his friend Asa Gray, a botanist at Harvard. The package contained a message as well. "If you ever do read it and can screw out the time to send me however short a note," Darwin wrote, "I should be extremely grateful." That book was a copy of On the Origin of Species. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Gray did read it voraciously, and he scribbled his impressions all over the margins as he did so. He then circulated that single copy among friends and colleagues, including Bronson Alcott, the humanitarian Charles Loring Brace, and naturalist and author Henry David Thoreau. As my guest will tell us, that volume had an extraordinary impact on these New England intellectuals and on the gathering strength of the movement to abolish slavery in the United States. Randall Fuller is Chapman Professor of English at the University of Tulsa and author of The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. He joins us this hour from the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Randy, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
It's interesting enough just to consider how Darwin's ideas struck American intellectuals at a key moment in history. But this single copy of On the Origin of Species literally making history is really extraordinary. How did you realize that there was one book that started everything?
Well, I'm a literary scholar, a literary historian, and so I kind of came around this topic through the back door, as it was. I was reading a biography of Henry David Thoreau and just encountered a single sentence that said on New Year's Day, 1860, Thoreau had encountered for the first time Darwin's, you know, masterwork on the Origin of Species. And I remember kind of thinking, that's interesting. I always think of Darwin's work as coming to the U.S. during or even after the Civil War. And based upon that one sentence, I began to do some excavation of libraries and archives and discovered, I was able to locate the book that Thoreau had first seen and trace it back to Asa Gray.
Who was Gray, and how did he and Darwin become friendly?
Asa Gray was the first chaired botanist at Harvard College. He was largely self-taught, an incredibly energetic intellect, a wiry small guy, weighed about 135 pounds, and hiked through the Appalachians and Adirondacks cataloging American plants. And he made a name for himself as having a mind particularly good at classifying North American botany. And he met Darwin several times on trips to England, where he was trying to further his education. But eventually in the 1850s, as Darwin was secretly working on The Origin of Species, he contacts Asa Gray, asking him for a number of examples and data that he might be able to use for his book.
Is it going too far to say that Gray and Darwin collaborated?
It's going too far to say that only Gray and Darwin collaborated. Darwin had an enormous correspondence. He was somewhat reclusive in his house in southern England, but he corresponded with scientists throughout Europe and the United States, and almost like a spider weaving a web, he collected data from this vast network of scientists. And so, you know, the theory was his, but the illustrations and evidence that he used came from really a wide variety of other scientists.
I want to step back for a moment here and talk about what was revolutionary about the content of Darwin's book. It wasn't that no one had ever imagined that something like evolution could exist. How did his ideas propel existing thinking about the mechanisms for evolution?
Yeah, you're exactly right. There had been this idea that species evolved one from the other for at least 60 or 70 years, and quite a bit longer if you go all the way back to the Greek writer Ovid. But what Darwin did that was revolutionary is he came up with a process that was entirely physical or entirely material that did not, and it was a perfect explanation for how the speciation of plants and animals could occur. And essentially that idea is called natural selection. That was the term he came up with.
The idea that we humans might be part of nature is not remarkable today. We get that we're animals, although we tend to separate ourselves. This was a stunning thing, though, to consider in the 19th century.
It was. And in many ways, that aspect of Darwin's thinking probably has had the most lasting impact. It runs smack up against a longstanding religious tradition that humans had been created separately by God in God's image and were somehow existed in a space between animals and angels.
Hmm. Before Asa Gray passed his copy along, he read it just exceptionally carefully. He wrote all over it. What did he put in the margins?
Well, one of the things that he put in the margins in almost every single page of the book is exclamation points, asterisks, vertical lines. When I encountered the book, which is located at Harvard, and began to flip through, the excitement that he felt was palpable in this marginalia. And then he writes on occasions, yes, I think so too, or sometimes he disagrees with Darwin, and he'll make the argument that Darwin's pushing on a piece of evidence a little too hard. The back of the book is filled with ruminations about the kinds of things he's read in Darwin's book, as well as some corrections. And for me, most interestingly, on the flyleaf at the back of the book, in pencil, he's written the word idealistic on the top and on the bottom, materialistic.
Hmm. How influential were Gray's notes on the way his friends read the book after him?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure that we have yet a theory that adequately explains how the enthusiasm of one reader communicates itself to another reader. But I can tell you that that Gray went around Cambridge, Massachusetts in the winter of 1859, 1860, telling as many people as he could about Darwin's book and eventually passing it on to his wife's relative, Charles Loring Brace.
Hmm. Brace was a philanthropist. For people who don't recognize that name today, tell us a little bit about the causes that he was passionate about.
Sure. Charles Loring Brace is largely forgotten today, but his memory lives on in something called the Orphan Trains, which was a program that he invented in New York City in the 1850s to gather the orphans of immigrant children, mainly Irish and German immigrants, who were living more or less homeless and on the streets of Lower Manhattan, and to put them on trains to out west. Out west at first was Pennsylvania, but eventually became Ohio and North Dakota and all the way to the West Coast. And these kids were placed with farm families in the belief that working on a farm and being a part of a family would make them productive members of society. So that was the principle. That was the principal cause that Brace was involved in. The other one that he was no less passionate about was abolition.
Hmm. What did he discover? He read On the Origin of Species, Brace did, more than a dozen times. What did he discover in Darwin's writing that motivated his activism?
Well, one of the things that he discovered was, or thought he discovered, because it's arguably not really in On the Origin of Species, but he believed that Darwin's theory suggested that humankind would progress ever upward towards greater and greater perfection. And so that was a kind of validation for Brace that the reform work that he was doing was meaningful and would lead to a better society. But the other idea that he encountered that connected to his abolitionism was Darwin's insistence that all organisms, plants and animals, shared a common ancestor. And this, for him, proved that blacks and whites were not different species or even in any significant way different races, but were in fact brothers and sisters.
So when you say that On the Origin of Species didn't support this idea that humans were on this like ever upward trajectory, Darwin didn't go so far as to discuss human beings at all in that book.
That's right. Darwin was a very cagey person that way. He knew that he was crossing into all kinds of controversial areas if he made the suggestion that humans had evolved from lower animals. And so he just brackets the notion of human beings completely out of On the Origin of Species. Nevertheless, everyone who read that book immediately inserted humans into it.
Great Britain had outlawed slavery half a century before Darwin was writing, but were they any less likely to be racist than the United States?
I don't think so. There certainly are a number of, kind of racist cartoons and stereotypes that one can find in English literature and magazines of the time. On the other hand, there just wasn't a very large population of people from other races in England in 1850. But you're also entirely correct that they had outlawed slavery half a century earlier, and basically, or fundamentally, emancipation of slaves and the ending of the slave trade by Great Britain was fueled by Darwin's grandparents.
So Charles Loring Brace read Darwin and said, well, we all have a common ancestor, therefore we cannot justify enslaving a certain segment of the human population because they have darker skin. Other people took this book and went in a very different direction. Can you talk about Asa Gray's Harvard colleague, Louis, and is it Agassiz?
Agassiz. Louis Agassiz was born in Switzerland. And by the time he was about 25, he was one of the most recognized zoologists in the world. He was the expert on fish. And he came and gave a speaking tour in America in the 1840s at a time when the United States very much wanted to be a part of larger world culture. And he was recruited by the president of Harvard and given a very, a very great position at Harvard as their comparative zoologist, and was given funding to create a lavish and wonderful museum that's actually still there in Cambridge. But Agassiz had a theory that all species, plants, animals, and moving all the way to human beings, had been created specially and independently by God. All blacks and whites had been created in their own sphere, and there were no common origins as far as Agassiz was concerned.
My guest is Randall Fuller. He's Chapman Professor of English at the University of Tulsa and author of The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the summer of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the Chapman Professor of English at the University of Tulsa, Randall Fuller. His new book is called The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. You can join us by finding us on Twitter at KERA Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Randy, to go back just for a minute to Louis Agassiz, he believed it was possible that different species could be evolving, but not together. He didn't condone slavery, but people who did found his ideas to be very much a confirmation of how they felt and how they were able to justify this practice.
That's right. And I should go back for a second and say Agassiz was an incredibly talented and brilliant scientist. He was also the son of a pastor in Switzerland. And when he looked around the world at all of the diversity of species, plants, animals, and again, people, his hypothesis was that God had created all of those species in particular biological or ecological niches. So, for example, a whale in the North Atlantic had been created by God there. A toucan in South America had been created specifically by God there. And he extrapolated from this theory to suggest that white people had been created in Europe or near the Caucasus Mountains, and that's where we get the term Caucasian from. That black people had been created specifically in Africa, that red-skinned people had been created in North America, et cetera, et cetera. Part of that theory was picked up by others in American scientific circles, and the argument became something along the lines of the white race was the closest God had gotten to perfecting humans, that other races were sort of failed experiments or failed trials in other places. And this fed into the pro-slavery ideology that black people were inferior to whites and that slavery was a sort of natural order of things.
God comes up a lot in this book, and I think that's interesting, particularly because the debates that exist today over evolution tend to center around this idea that if one believes that species are subject to natural selection and are evolving, that might be mutually exclusive with faith in a creator God.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things I tried to trace out in my book is the various ways that people who believe in God or a divinity of some sort or the other either made accommodations or rejected Darwin's theory or tried to synthesize the new science with an old form of religious belief.
This was a real challenge for Bronson Alcott, who, again, was much more famous than his daughter in his own time, but today is not as famous as Louisa May Alcott.
Yeah, that's right. Bronson Alcott is a sort of whimsical, comical character when we look back at him now. He was famously improvident, once went out on a six-month speaking tour and came back with $5. And in some way, this was both deeply annoyed his soon to be famous daughter, but also spoke to the fact that he was an idealist, somebody who could care less about the material workings of the physical world, whose head was always in the clouds, as it were. And Alcott rejected almost immediately out of hand Darwin's theory because for him, Darwin began with material processes, with the way one could alter the breed of a dog, or all of this vast information about plants and animals. And Alcott's argument was Darwin should have started with God, and worked his way down rather than the other way, rather than the way that Darwin did.
He was a transcendentalist. How did transcendentalist philosophy sort of weave its way through the New England abolitionist movement?
Well, transcendentalism, first and foremost, believed that God, or again, the divinity, or as Ralph Waldo Emerson would call it, the soul, permeated everything on earth. So one of the reasons that the transcendentalists were so keen on going into nature was because God had suffused nature with his being. And if you really wanted a sense of the Godhead, you went into the woods and you kind of communed with the creeks and the stones and the trees. The other tenet of transcendentalism was that God resided in every human, and that as a result there was a potential for every human to become godlike or more perfect. And when you translate that idea to African Americans and accord full humanity and the divine spark in Black slaves, the fact that some of those people are in chains or oppressed through chattel slavery becomes deeply anathema. So the transcendentalists were among the most fervent and active abolitionists in the 1850s in America.
We've talked a lot so far this hour about how white people responded to slavery and abolitionism based on the works of Darwin. What do we know about how leading Black intellectuals of the day, people like Frederick Douglass, responded to this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there was a double-edged sword for African-American intellectuals that I think kept them largely on the sidelines during the first year that Darwin's book came out. On the one hand, as I've been talking about, Darwin's theory suggested that Blacks and whites were brothers and sisters. And this, of course, played beautifully into the abolitionist and anti-slavery movements. But on the other hand, Darwin's theory also suggested that humans had derived from primate ancestors. He doesn't say that in his book, but it was immediately discussed in both England and America. And African Americans had already had a long history of being equated with or connected to gorillas, apes, and other primates. And so they were understandably wary of promoting Darwinism too much.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jeffrey calling from Dallas. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi. I wanted to ask about Darwin as it relates to the full title of his book, The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, and the subtitle, The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life, and how that helped to feed the eugenics movement, especially as the end of slavery approached, first the positive eugenics and then the negative eugenics, and how all of that relates to what Gregor Mendel taught the scientists of genetics, who basically said that all people came from Black people.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a series of really interesting questions. And I should say, first of all, that my book really focuses on Darwin's reception before the Civil War in this country. But it is true that one of the things about Darwin's theory in general is that it is easily appropriated by all sorts of different ideologies. And so there was, in fact, an eugenics effort later in the late 19th century that made an argument that if natural selection is working for the adaptability and the betterment of species, then over time, what perhaps we should do is try to make sure that the weaker, the more feeble, et cetera, are not allowed to reproduce. And of course, there are all sorts of troubling implications with that. The other thing that I would add is that Darwin's theory was in some risk of fading out in the early 20th century until Mendelian genetics were rediscovered.
Franklin Sanborn makes an appearance in this book as well, heavily involved in funding the activities of John Brown. Remind us who Sanborn was and how he saw Darwin's book as a kind of metaphor for the conditions in this country.
Sure. Sanborn was is the youngest character in my book. So he's a second generation transcendentalist. If Bronson Alcott was the first, he's the second, and he's about 30 years younger or so than Bronson Alcott. And he was much more socially active than most other transcendentalists, and like Charles Loring Brace, was a radical abolitionist who went around the state of Massachusetts collecting money from wealthy abolitionists in order to fund Kansas Free State settlers and eventually to fund John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry in Virginia, where Brown hoped to free up a large cache of weapons, distribute them to local slaves, and to foment a slave rebellion that would end slavery. So Sanborn was arguably the most radical abolitionist in New England in 1860 when he first learns about Darwin's book. And what he sees in that book is a depiction of nature as constantly at war, as species and varieties of species constantly fighting in a very competitive and deadly way to gain their niche in a environment. And he translates that into the American scene, and he makes this argument that because the North and the South are struggling in the continental U.S. To either have a pro-slave or anti-slave United States, only one of them will be able to prevail, and only that region which is most fit will survive.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Randall Fuller. We're talking about the book that changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. That's the name of Randy's new book. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Randy, did a lot of women read this book before the Civil War?
That's a wonderful question and a somewhat difficult to answer question. And the reason it's somewhat difficult to answer is because women were not yet in the academic environment that first received Darwin. There was a wonderful, wise and extremely well-read and learned woman named Sarah Alden Ripley in Concord, Massachusetts, who in many ways was an intellectual leader of that small town, and whom we know read Darwin's Origin of Species within a month or two of its arrival in the United States. But the record is really slim because as a woman, her papers were not collected, her letters weren't kept, her journals were dispensed with in a way that her more well-known male Concordites material wasn't.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak with Mark in Frisco. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy the show.
Thanks.
This sounds like a fascinating book. I am concerned a bit about what is perhaps a bit of historical cherry-picking. I recognize you're a literary scholar and not a historian, but all historical accounts. I'd be concerned about placing so much of the impetus behind the abolitionist movement on Darwin's writings or on the elder Darwin family, particularly when the Catholic Church has already officially condemned slavery in the late 1600s, and that by all historical accounts, the contemporary abolitionist movement starts with the writings of the Quakers in America and in England in the 1700s.
Well, give us some more context there, Randy.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And my argument isn't that Darwin creates or really fuels the abolitionist movement. It's rather that in 1860, when Darwin's book first arrives in America, the nation is already so galvanized and so caught up with abolition and the question of slavery that it's as if, you know, it's almost as if a little bomb was dropped in the middle of that society. But you're completely right. The abolitionist movement in the United States goes back at least to the 18th century, and in the 19th century, William Lloyd Garrison and many other abolitionists are writing in the 1830s. So it's not that Darwin created that. It's more as though his book came at an especially tense moment in the abolitionist and slave debate.
When did On the Origin of Species find its way into Henry David Thoreau's hands?
Well, he was at the dinner party on January 1st, New Year's Day, 1860, with Charles Loring Brace, Bronson Alcott, and Franklin Sanborn, when Brace brought Asa Gray's copy to dinner and began discussing this book. In Henry David Thoreau's inimitable way, he began to pester the Concord Library to get a copy as soon as it could. And they managed to get a copy on January 23rd. So just 23 days after the first British copy arrived, the Concord Library got its own copy. And Thoreau was not surprisingly the first person to check it out and then recheck it out and took notes for about two or three weeks after he checked it out. And so that's his first encounter with Darwin's book. But that encounter extends throughout the year 1860. And as I argue in my book, changes the direction of the work he would do for the rest of his life.
All right, we'll talk about that in just a moment with my guest, Randall Fuller, who's professor of English at the University of Tulsa and author of The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. We do have lines open if you'd like to join us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Diane Jay, internationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is Randall Fuller, Chapman Professor of English at the University of Tulsa and author of The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. Randy, we tend to mistakenly remember Thoreau as this sort of dreamy hermit. He was less isolated than many people realize, and he had broader interests than many remember.
That's exactly right. Thoreau in 1860 was arguably one of the most accomplished field naturalists in America. He was arguably one of the most accomplished geologists. He was a self-trained surveyor. He was interested in almost everything. And we know him from his wonderful book, Walden, where he presents himself as this isolated hermit who goes into the woods to discover God and self-fulfillment and to have kind of spiritual enlightenment. But in fact, by the time Walden was published in 1852, Thoreau was already well on his way to becoming a scientist. He was reading scientific journals, periodicals, books, and more importantly, every day of his life, he was going outside for 4 hours and walking through the fields and meadows of Concord, taking notes and compiling data and information about his natural surroundings.
Did he have a special hat that he invented for himself?
He did. He had this wonderful, it wasn't a top hat, but it had a fairly large crown, and he'd built a little platform in it so that he could store botanical specimens that he found on his walks through Concord. And there's a kind of plant that apparently the seed pods will explode periodically. And he put those in his hat one day and was walking home and then thought there was gunfire over his head because he'd forgotten those seed pods were there.
Hmm. How specifically was he inspired by Darwin? What was it that he read in Darwin's work that made him sort of shift the direction of what he was working on?
Well, as I said, he'd been collecting data for almost 8 years. And when I say data, I mean, you know, every month he's out there chronicling when the ice melts on Walden Pond, when the leaves of the sugar maple open and then bloom and then fall off the trees, how deep the snow is in April. All of this amazing data that scientists continue to look at. But he didn't really have a theory or a plan for handling that data. He seems to have just been collecting it. And Darwin provided for him a model of how a scientific hypothesis and theory could make sense of all of that data. So one of the arguments that I make is that Thoreau spends the last couple of years of his life attempting to show that some of Darwin's ideas are in fact legitimate, can be backed up by the evidence that he sees in Concord.
So he was incredibly detail-oriented. How did he organize all that information?
So after reading Darwin, and that's important, before reading Darwin, he just put all this stuff in his journals. But after reading Darwin, he got these large newspaper-sized sheets of paper with a ruler and his family's pencil. He made incredibly detailed spreadsheets. When I was working on the book, I was trying to discover whether a spreadsheet had been invented before, and I ended up not being able to determine that, but this is a really early vision of an Excel spreadsheet. And what he does is he puts every month of the year in one column, and then he puts this list of literally hundreds of plant species or animal species, and he describes them month by month. So he's creating this kind of elaborate calendar that shows the natural, the way nature has patterns and moves throughout the year.
When you say his family's pencil, people may not realize that the Thoreau family supported itself with a pencil factory.
That's exactly right. The Thoreau family made what were widely considered to be the best pencils in antebellum America. And one of the, you know, to add yet another job to Henry David Thoreau's resume, one of the things that he did was invent both a better way of producing the pencil and a better lead, a better mixture for the lead and clay that was used in the pencil. And before he did that, his family struggled financially. After he did that, his family moved pretty quickly into Concord's middle class.
How interested was Thoreau in the abolitionist movement?
Thoreau was a passionate abolitionist as well. We may remember him from his famous essay, Civil Disobedience, where he spent a night in jail for not paying his poll tax. The reason he did that was because that poll tax, he felt, was supporting the U.S. Invasion into what then was Mexico. And the reason that invasion was being made was to spread slavery farther west. So he was opposed to slavery. He and his sister actually were so-called engineers on the Underground Railroad. They would take in escaped runaway slaves, feed them if they were wounded, help them get better, and then take them farther north. And Thoreau then became the most ardent spokesperson for John Brown after the Harper's Ferry affair in late 1859.
So you've already mentioned this this New Year's Day party. What do we know about the kinds of discussions that these early readers, American readers of On the Origin of Species, had among themselves?
They primarily talked about two things, or at least two things that they saw fit to record. And I should just say parenthetically, one of the wonderful things about working with the people from this period and from this sort of intellectual environment is they wrote down everything. Mm-hmm. So we can really trace their conversation. The two things that they spoke about were abolition and John Brown on the one hand, and Darwin's new book on the other.
All right, let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Mike is calling from Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I wonder if the author could elaborate a little bit on Darwin's parents' role in the anti-slavery issue in England, and if that had any causal precedent or whatever influence on what Darwin was looking for.
Yeah, there's a wonderful book called Darwin's Sacred Cause, which makes the argument that his family's anti-slavery beliefs and efforts helped him to find slavery so odious that his theory grows out of that. That may be a bit of a stretch. We have to remember that Darwin was first and foremost a scientist, but it is true his parents were active in the anti-slavery movement. His wife's parents were Wedgwood. We may know Wedgwood pottery, and one of their most famous bits of pottery in the first half of the 19th century was a medallion that had a slave bent on one knee with his hands raised to a white man saying, am I not a brother? So Darwin was deeply affected by the anti-slavery movement when he went on the voyage of the Beagle, the trip around the world on a journey of exploration in the 1830s. He encountered slavery firsthand, mainly in Brazil, and he writes in his account of that voyage how terrible and dehumanizing slavery was. So he was deeply sympathetic to readings of his book that contributed to the abolitionist cause. I think it may be a stretch to say that his abolitionism or his anti-slavery beliefs created his theory of natural selection, however.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Randall Fuller. We're discussing The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Randy, is it going too far to describe Darwin as political? Would he have thought of himself that way? He had a moral position on slavery.
Yeah, that's a great question, because Darwin, on the one hand, did everything he could to stay out of the public eye, to keep himself holed up in his estate in southern England, but he followed the Civil War almost daily, and we know this from letters that he shared with Asa Gray. And Asa Gray would write letters to Darwin about the course of the war, whether there was Union victories or Union defeats, and they would invariably make what are kind of jokes but are also kind of serious about how the stronger species will survive.
Do we know anything about the contents of Asa Gray's letter back to Charles Darwin after he so carefully read On the Origin of Species?
Well, we do. He initially is quite enthusiastic about the book and promises to do everything he can, not only to get the book printed in the United States, but also to proselytize Darwinian theory to Americans, which he does. In the pages of the Atlantic Monthly in a series of three essays. But as the year 1860 unfolds, Gray becomes increasingly concerned and uneasy about the way that Darwinian theory poses a threat for religion. And one of the things we haven't mentioned is that Asa Gray, in addition to being the premier botanist of his generation, was also a deeply devout, born-again Presbyterian.
So what did he do with that discomfort? How did he just rectify those different ideas?
Well, he goes back and forth in a wonderful series of letters with Darwin throughout 1860, where the two really raise this question and discuss and debate it. But ultimately, where Asa Gray comes down is he says, I believe that Darwin's natural selection is the way that species come into being. I also believe that God is using natural selection to create the world that he wants.
I didn't realize that we could blame Bronson Alcott, at least indirectly, for Thoreau's untimely death.
Yes, Bronson Alcott caught the flu and was one of those friends that we all have who, even though they're contagious, insist upon socializing anyway, and that's exactly what happened with Thoreau. He went to visit his good friend Bronson Alcott. They visited daily, and he went to visit him when Alcott was sick with the flu, and a couple of days later, Thoreau began to exhibit symptoms of the flu, but that flu seems to have exacerbated a latent case of tuberculosis.
Hmm. How widely read was On the Origin of Species before the Civil War? Is there any way to know?
Well, we know that the initial print run in England of 1500 sold out immediately. And over the course of 1860, there were three editions in England. In the United States, the first edition came out on late January. And there were three editions as well during that first year. So although the numbers may sound kind of low, I think we're talking about 10,000, 15,000, something like that, copies sold in England and America. That constituted actually, if not a bestseller, certainly a very widely read book.
Randall Fuller is Chapman Professor of English at the University of Tulsa, and he's author of The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. Randy, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
And thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Mine is at Chris Boyd Think. Subscribe to our podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.